For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Welcome, everybody, to Parshas Korach, 5773, and a special welcome to my dear father, Chazen Goldberger, who is visiting. Okay, the Parsha is Korach. The theme this year is a lesson for any Jew, any time. And when it comes to Korach, that's not hard, because Korach is a Parsha which instructs us by a real live example of the destructiveness of machlokes, which means argumentation, rivalry, contentiousness, and all of the above. It is something that is very, very basic to human nature. Unfortunately, that's the way God made us, and we have a tremendous power of destruction that we're capable of relationships and of a lot more. We also have the power of control. So what I'd like to do is devote the class today to some of the perspectives that we gain from our rabbis about the topic of machlokes, and of course the flip side, the positive side, which is peace. Shalom. Okay? I haven't said anything yet. Okay. Anyway, what I'm going to do today really is share the insights that I gained through my friend Alan Smirin, who always, he studies for me. he diligently, all week long, reads Parsha Sefarim in English, and when he sees something that he thinks is very meaningful to any Jew at any time, he says, you've got to read this. You've got to talk about this. And today we have some very important perspectives. So I'd like to start off with the first point about machlokes is how severe it can be, and what is really the mechanics of machlokes, of divisiveness. For this point, I'm going to share with you something from the writings of Rabbi Yisachar Frand, Shlita. May he live and be well. He's one of the Torah teachers in Neri Yisrael in Baltimore, and he's also a sought-after speaker internationally. My claim to fame is that I used to be his cross the hall neighbor. And his next-door neighbor was Rabbi and Mrs. Friedman from Dunwoody. Those were in the good old days when we still lived in the housing and in the Neri Yisrael campus. Rabbi Fran shares with us the mechanics of machlokes. A number of sins are associated with machlokes: slander, jealousy, hatred, public humiliation. But the core evil of machlokes is the obsessive need to be victorious. The quarrel may begin over some genuine issue, but before long it flares out of control and takes on a life of its own. The original issue is no longer so important. Winning is important. You know that there are actually people who don't speak with each other and they don't remember how it started? Brothers may get into an argument over a few $1,000s of inheritance. The quarrel begins with the money, which is moderately significant. But once it gets started, it leads into all sorts of other directions. The brothers stop going to each other's simchas. They stop talking to each other. They burn with hatred and resentment. And all over what? $5,000. No, it's more than that. It's a personality conflict. It's an ego thing. I will not let him win out over me. I will show him who is right. It's not the money. It's the principle of the matter. Oho, says Rabbi Fran, once you hear that it's the principle of the matter, you know things have gone from bad to horrendous. Look how insane is this thing called machlokas, comments the Chafetz Chaim. Ask any parent. Now, what I'm about to read to you is downright shocking and ugly. And I'm sorry to make you feel uncomfortable. I felt uncomfortable reading it, but it's just something that I guess once a year we have to confront the realities of these things. How destructive machlokas can be. I mean, I was literally shocked at what I'm about to read to you, and I apologize in advance. The Chofetz Chaim says it's insane. Ask any parent if he would allow someone else to harm his child. Of course not. Ask any parent if he himself would harm his child. Preposterous. But it is proven that machlokes harms the children. And the source for this is in our parsha, where Korach started a machlokes. I'm sorry. I hope everyone is familiar with the story. Just very, very basically, the Jews had come out of Egypt, and they were had built the tabernacle, and they had begun the first Jewish settlement. Moshe Rabbeinu was the leader. He was the prophet from God, and everyone revered him and knew that he was a humble man, and his words were directly from the mouth of God. That is, everyone except for one man who challenged his authority, who accused him of nepotism, and from that he gathered many other people. He was a distinguished leader as well, Korach. He gathered other people on his side. And in the end, Korach and his entire family, including babies, were swallowed up into the earth's belly. Okay? What?
The ground.
The ground. From here, the sages say how drastic is machlokas, because in any other sin of the Torah, a child is not held accountable. And yet, on account of Korach's argumentation, even the babies were destroyed. So that's what Rabbi Frand is going to say here. So, ask any parent if he would allow anyone else to harm his child. No. Would he himself harm his child? Of course not. Ridiculous. But it is proven that machlokas harms children. So how can people play this dangerous game? And yet they do. Their need for vindication, for validation, for victory, all the V's, is so great that they are blinded to the dangers. It is incredible. And here is the shocking story. Two people in the Chofetz Chaim's town, that's Poland, became embroiled in a machlokas. As one would expect, the situation deteriorated as time went on, becoming uglier and messier. Then the children of the two antagonists mysteriously began to die. The Chofetz Chaim decided that enough was enough. He went to one of the parties and said, "Don't you think it's time to stop? This is killing your children. Think about the children." An evil gleam appeared in the man's eyes. He leaned forward and said, "Rebbe, I will bury all of them, but I am going to win." I wouldn't believe it if I didn't believe that Rabbi Frand is telling us a real story. As a famous American sports figure once said, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. This is not the Torah way. It is pagan. The story of Korach teaches us how far we can descend once we embark on the road to machlokas. We must avoid taking even the first step. Okay, first part. That's the hard part. It gets better, don't worry. So, point number one, it can be terrible. Point number two, how can we avoid machlokas? How can we avoid being a party to, or even when we see other people involved in machlokas, how can we possibly make a difference? So I'd like to share with you on this point some very wonderful insights from Rabbi Pliskin, who is a Torah psychologist. Rabbi Pliskin has written many, many books on Torah psychology. And this is what he says. I'll try to say it in my own words so I'm not just sitting here and reading to you. It says in the Chumash today, below yihye k'korach v'chad aso. People should not be like Korach and like his assembly. In other words, let's learn from this story that we don't want to be like that. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says that you could also interpret the verse as a statement of fact. There is never a machlokes, a dispute, like the one between Korach and Moshe. Why? Because that is perhaps the one time in history when one side was all right and one side was all wrong. Lo tiyeh k'korach. Most disputes are not where one side is all right and one side is all wrong. Both sides have validity. So, step one, how to avoid machlokas. As difficult as it may seem at the beginning, try to put yourself in the other person's shoes. Try to see things from their side. Because maybe they have a point. Maybe you're right, but maybe he's also right. I heard a delicious story from my friend Alan. These two people were arguing about a cow. One insisted that the cow was brown, and one insisted that the cow was white. Ridiculous, right? Two grown men. It's brown. No, it's white. And they were standing there, and the cow was right in front of them. Colorblind? No. The story goes that Shmulek is standing over here, and Yankel is standing over here. Well, the cow happened to be brown on one side and white on the other side. So Shmulek was 100% right, and Yankel was 100% right. It all depends on what side of the issue you're on. And Rabbi Pliskin says that it's almost always the case that in most arguments and feuds, even if one side is more correct than the other, both sides are usually making some mistakes. So a person then, especially once you're embroiled, it's not easy to step aside, step out of yourself. But really a person should do that. And a person should step back and say, what did I do that could have possibly contributed to this flare-up? Maybe it's the way I said it. Maybe I didn't give the other person credit in a certain area and he was slighted, he was offended, and that caused him to say what he said. So if we are to learn from the Parsha not to be like Korach, we have to learn how to take responsibility for our part in contributing to the machlokas, because it really takes two to tango. In the case of Korach and Moshe, Korach, he was all wrong. Moshe had done nothing wrong, literally nothing wrong. But lo tiyeh k'korach, nobody, we don't have those kind of debates and issues in our lives. In our lives, there's always two sides of the story. A lot of times, Rabbi Pliskin says, it's not really the issue, it's the personalities. It could be a clash between personalities. Again, it could be the way people speak. It could be an affront. And therefore, the lesson from the Parsha is, what did I do to contribute to the machlokas? Okay. And then, the other thing we learn is that Moshe, even though Moshe was right and Korach was wrong, Moshe was the one who sought to make peace. If you read the narrative, I won't read it inside, but if you read the narrative, you will see that Moshe several times tried to speak to Korach. He said, let's sleep on it. He spoke to him calmly. He spoke to him rationally. and the other people that joined Korach, Dasan and Aviram, he sent message to them. When they didn't respond, he personally went to them. So we see that even when somebody is in the right, they should still take the initiative and be the peacemaker. There are always, Baruch Hashem, people in families or in communities that they pride themselves in being peacemakers, in being non-contentious, and on the contrary, trying to mediate. I've got one of those people sitting to my right, who my father actually in his later in his career became actually a mediator, and it's a skill. It takes a certain kind of character and personality to be the peacemaker, but everyone loves the peacemaker because they realize that such a person is so valuable to have. But my final point is to talk about the benefits of peace, because perhaps if we understood the cost,
cost benefit ratio.
Okay, we would maybe be able to think about it, and it's hard to do that when you're in the heat of the moment. But if we were to understand what is the reason that peace is preferable to argumentation, maybe that would be a motivation, and that could develop with time. By the way, a great line I once heard, I think it was from Mrs. Feldman. Do you want to be right, or do you want peace? Do you want power, or do you want peace? In other words, what's the ultimate goal here? Is the goal to be right? Like, who cares? Oh, another line somebody once said, you ever heard the expression, dead right? You know, you want to be right?
Or
you want to be
right.
Dead right? Like, okay, you'll be right, but you'll be dead right. So what's the benefit? So I think that may be the next step and could be something that one has to mature and to appreciate. Now, if a person never graduates from the mindset of I've got to be right, if they think the way they were as adults when they were children in the playing field, then there may not be any hope for them. But if they understand the virtue, the benefits of the virtue of peace, for example, our sages say that if you want bracha, if you want to be blessed with good blessings, good health, you know, prosperity, happiness, what is the vessel that contains all of these blessings from Hashem? There's no vessel that contains blessing like peace. Peace is the vessel. You want to have a good life? You want to have a happy life? Get peace. So we'll spend a few minutes just talking about the benefits of peace, and then we'll close with that. Yeah.
There was a Rebbetzin here a number of years ago who was talking on Shalom Bayis, and her take on that was, do you want to be right, or do you want to be married?
Okay.
It's you get married first and then you're right. You
know? No, you get married first and then she's right.
Then she's right. Then you can change
her. You're right. Yeah.
What were you going to say?
There's an old story about newlyweds who couldn't decide where to go for the honeymoon.
Uh-huh.
The husband wanted to go to the mountains. The wife wanted to go to the seashore. So they compromised. They went to the seashore.
Very good. Very good. Yes.
I still say that
learn
to validate.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would turn things around
in
such a way. And so you had an adult coach, and you have this child, and you're expecting this child to accept this adult without the adult saying, possibly, I know you see it this way.
Uh-huh.
This is the way I see it, and I'm
yeah.
the coach, so I
yeah.
have to call it this way.
Yeah.
And maybe that way you.
Yeah. Right. That's true. That's true.
Two comments on relationships. First of all, if you've ever had two boys, this one's 3 years old. He's got a bigger piece of cake than I do. They fight over that. And then there's the other thing that has to do with the Oedipus thing. Sons hate their father.
What?
You know, kids hate their father. Until finally they grow up.
Uh-huh.
They grow up and they realize, you know, their father isn't so bad.
Yeah.
And then they finally grow up and they say, you know, my father was right.
It takes a long time.
In the psychological marital counseling, what we often do is role reversal. You know, you take this side, you take that side. And they can make, because there is some common ground.
And it has to do with being able to see the other person's point of view.
But child father is a very common thing. Okay. A lot of kids, you know, they're 70 before they can finally realize that their father was not such a bad guy.
Well, I skipped that stage. All right. What? Yeah. Baruch Hashem.
That's Oedipus. Oedipus always...
Your father wouldn't let you.
Oedipus ended up killing his father.
What, that's a Greek?
Yeah,
Greek
mythology? He killed his father and married his mother. And he lived unhappily ever after.
Hmm.
But that's another story.
Well, that's the Greek story.
Yeah. Not the Torah way. That's pagan. Okay. So, final stage. What are the benefits of peace? So, for this presentation, let me share with you something from Rav Aaron Feldman, who's the brother of our Rabbi Emeritus, also currently the Rosh Yeshiva in Baltimore Yeshiva, Rav Aaron Feldman, and a book that he wrote in 1987, A Torah Guide to Successful Marriage, called The River, the Kettle, and the Bird. Did you read this? The River, the Kettle, and the Bird is taken from a statement in the Talmud, which the Hebrew text is, Omar Rav Hanan said, Shalosh Shalomos Hain. There are three types of peace. Nahar, the river, Tzipor, the bird, Ukedera, and the kettle. Okay? That, by the way, that tractate is, or that section of the Talmud is dealing with different dreams that a person might have, different visions. And it says, you know, if you see these kinds of objects in your dream, it's a sign for X. So it says, if you see a river, a kettle, and a bird in your dream, you should anticipate peace, because these are signs of peace. So the obvious question is, how do these three objects signify peace? And what's the difference between them? So Rav Aaron Feldman, I have a suspicion that it may be influenced by the writings of the Maharal, but I can't be sure. In the beginning of this book, which is really meant for marriage, he says that these objects are three different symbols of peace, and they represent three possible levels of peace. Okay, so there's three. We're now going to learn about three possible levels of peace. There's different kinds of peace. Okay, like you've heard, you know, there's coexistence versus harmony, etc. So this is what Rabbi Feldman, how he explains the three objects, and hopefully that will be just, you know, food for thought to inspire us for the virtues of peace so that we will want to pursue it. Again, if I'm not looking for peace, then why am I going to back down from trying to be right? But if I see the benefits of peace, I might rethink it. The first level of peace, the lowest form, which is just the absence of conflict, that is symbolized by the river. Okay, the way that is explained is, a river is a vehicle of commerce between two cities. Okay, you've got one city upstream, you've got another city downstream. They want to do commerce. Upstream city wants to sell its wares to the second city, and vice versa. They're going to use the river as a means of transporting their goods. And so... The river represents a state of communication which exists between two separate entities connected only by their mutual benefit. I, as a member of one city, don't have any particular affinity or alliance with the second city, but I benefit from them, and therefore I want there to be, you know, communication, I want there to be transportation so that I can get what I need. And so I'm not going to blockade the river. I'm not going to boycott their products because I need them. That is one level of peace. And it is the absence of conflict, true, but it's on a very basic level. A kettle represents the second level of peace. A kettle is designed to prepare food by utilizing the combined talents of water and fire. Water alone would ruin the food. You're just going to soak the food in the water. You're not going to get it edible. Fire alone would burn it. But through the mediatory effect of the kettle, an environment proper for cooking is created. The kettle harnesses the talent of water to retain the heat, and the talent of fire to produce it to create an edible product. The kettle has thus made possible a productive peace between fire and water. Okay. All right. So that brings together different talents and abilities and allows them to harmonize. But then again, if I'm not hungry and I don't need the food, so then the fact that I've got a kettle that can make peace between the fire and the water doesn't, I don't need it. So the second degree of peace exists where two people or groups of people join together to reach a common goal, which neither alone would be able to achieve. And this you have very often in partnerships. Okay, I'm an MD, and I want to have a successful medical practice. I realize that if I'm a sole practitioner, I'm going to always be on call. I don't have expertise in every area, and therefore I really would like to expand the practice to include other physicians, and together we will have a more successful practice. So we enter into a partnership. This is it happens in all businesses and corporations. Nations join in mutual defense pacts. They become allies. This is more than just coexistence, okay? This represents a type of peace which is dynamic, resulting in the achievement of an objective which could not have been reached if not for peace. Ultimately, I would appreciate the other people in my partnership. I care about them because together with their help, we are able to build something bigger. Sounds good, right? Sounds like a pretty high level. Well, to carry that over to a marriage, you have marriages, okay, let's say a marriage in which goals are set which each partner would be unable to achieve separately. Neither can be breadwinner and household manager. Both. Neither can serve both as father and as mother. Each one needs the other to create a functioning household. And this creates a dependency, this creates a bond, and it's even an emotional bond. However, this also falls short. Because what happens when our needs aren't the same anymore? What happens when we don't need that income? Or what happens when the kids are gone? We don't have to raise them. So sometimes in a marriage, it can reach a point where we realize that the mutual dependency that we had is no longer necessary. So therefore, we have to move on to a higher level of peace. And that is represented by the bird. How does the bird represent peace? The third and final level of peace is the peace of the bird. The bird has two disparate talents: the ability to survive on earth as well as to fly in the heavens. These talents are not separate skills which exist side by side. Rather, they are details of a single organism which operates in these two realms. The way the bird walks on earth is affected by the way it is designed to fly. It has like light feet, you know? Conversely, the way it flies the heavens is affected by the way it is intended to walk the earth. It is simultaneously both an earthbound and airborne being. A bird, therefore, represents an embodiment of a peace where two natures and two entities have merged into one unit. The two parties to this sort of peace not only work together, but in doing so have merged into one unit. For example, the 50 states of the United States of America are not individual entities, although they do have their own, some degree of government, but they have submerged their individual identities into the common unit to which they belong. And in a marriage, this would mean that husband and wife are not just using each other or benefiting from the partnership, but they've actually merged together. And this can be true on relationships of all types, relationships among friends, relationships within communities. We see each other as a larger whole. In the case of your grandson, you know, he's young, or he was young then. He hasn't yet learned the benefit of being a chevraman, part of a group, part of a chabura, a group that makes each other stronger by pooling in their different abilities and talents. If you want to be part of that group, if you see the benefits, then of course you're going to be mevater. You're going to sometimes put your own rightness on the side because you want the greater good. And this is the kind of shalom that we have to aspire to. And I think if we understand this concept, if we work on it, we see the benefits of being a Klal Yisrael, a collective body of the Jewish people, then it will motivate us to want to try to let go of the rightness all the time and rather strive for the shlemos, for the completeness and the peace.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for the lesson.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.